Good morning. I am John Carlo. I am from Dallas County Health and Human Services. It's certainly a pleasure to be here today and speak in front of you. I'd like to thank the CDC for allowing me to present this information in this conference today, as well as my fellow panelists for very good presentations. Also, as the local health officer, I'd like to welcome you all to Dallas. I hope you've had an ample opportunity to enjoy our well-inspected and safe restaurants, and I hope you're having a good time while you're here. I do want to acknowledge that this study was supported by GSK. The outside scientific analysis by an outside company was performed with the assistance of GSK, as well as an assistance by a graduate student, Sharon Brumlett, who completed some last-minute statistical analysis prior to the presentation today. Thank you. So, as we've heard a little bit, the pertussis rates are increasing overall since 2000, and in part of the justification that we've heard in terms of the new adolescent vaccine has been the societal costs associated with pertussis. And studies have really shown that this disease and this illness, the costs associated with this illness is in fact one of the higher ones when compared to varicella or upper respiratory infections. And typically, the economic burden for these cases have been reported in terms of medical costs associated for treatment, as well as loss in productivity associated with missed work and school days. And this slide summarizes the available cost analyses which have been published in the literature. And some of these cost analyses do break this down by age, but for this slide, I only summarize them in general terms, looking at the specific indicators of medical costs and non-medical costs. And you can see that we have an average cost per case of ranging from $2,800 to up to $4,000, again, cost per case of pertussis. However, which is not in these cost analyses, and actually the authors of these papers have actually commented that one of the lacking pieces of information associated with the cost burden observed in the community is the public health related costs. Particularly for pertussis investigations, looking at the case investigation, the education that is performed during disease investigations, household prophylaxis costs, and reporting into databases, these costs have not been captured in previous case cost analyses. So the objective for this study was to look at exactly that. What is the cost of pertussis investigations by a local health department? And we took a look at some secondary objectives and looking at were there specific characteristics associated with cases which may in fact have impacted the cost of the case investigations. So we conducted a retrospective review of our 2004 data set. 419 cases were reported to the County Health Department. Keep in mind this is all cases, so this in conforming to the case definition includes confirmed, probable, and not a case. And we took from this retrospective sample a random sample for further analysis, which was weighted by the case classification, i.e. was it confirmed, probable, or not a case. And then we looked at specific variables, which we know were thought, or at least at the time we knew, would be potential cost effectors that would sort of be in terms of resource management or cost effectors. The study variables included the age, race, the zip code of the cases, the immunization status, and that is all immunizations, not just pertussis. And this is documented immunization status, i.e. either in a registry or by physician documentation, what the case status in fact was. And additionally, the number of contacts provided prophylaxis directly by the health department. Our health department does provide prophylaxis free of charge to contacts when indicated. Of course, the cases have options of receiving prophylaxis by their outside providers or through our medical doctors calling in prescriptions. But this study, we only looked at the cost when we directly gave the antimicrobials ourselves. What antimicrobial we used was also looked at, and whether English was spoken by a household member or not. So we took the retrospective review, took the random sample, and looked at specific costs in terms of time, what different activities are required to perform investigations, and we assembled these into categories. And the retrospective reviewers then were asked to look at how long each of these categories looked like it took based on the documentation in the case investigation reports. And just briefly, record generation and data entry. I've noticed I've got the old mnemonic for NEDS. I guess you all have the newer ones, but the CDC registry is in DSS, I guess now. But the data entry, completion of demographic information. Keep in mind, you know, when a pertussis case starts, it's usually just a name in a laboratory report. So we have to go back and find the rest of the demographic information, including the contact information for the case a lot of times. To begin the contact investigation, establishing contact for the case, you know, finding that telephone number and then getting a hold of the case or the parent of the case, counseling the case, completion of the standardized interview, dispensation of prophylaxis when indicated, and follow-up and other calls and case closure. The cost inputs that we looked at, this is $2,004, looking at the nurse investigator hourly wage, salary and indirect costs, as well as the per unit cost of erythromycin and azithromycin. And we then looked, these are the results. And the first thing we want to do is just sort of compare the random sample to the sample in 2004 to make sure we have a good representation of the overall cohort in 2004. And you can see the average age, race, sex, and confirmed case percentages correlated quite well with the overall sample based in 2004. And our median age, of note here, is somewhere between 6 and 8. So these are the results, and when we came through and added up the total estimated time for the cases in the random sample and took the cost inputs, we found that our mean cost per case was $211 with a standard deviation of $246. And one of the things I'd like to point out that's it's probably very apparent for those of us that are involved in these types of investigations is the real range that we're seeing here, particularly on the graph. In terms of cost distribution, you can see that many of the cases, including ones that may not have been a case, certainly may not cost $100 or less in per investigation. But there are a significant number of cases in the study that really show that cost is pretty substantial. Five cases in this example cost the local health department $500 or more in terms of a case investigation. So there certainly is a wide range of potential cost associated with case investigations depending on the factors. Some of the covariates in looking at them from our random sample, 16% of our random sample did not speak English in the household. The second language was Spanish in all of these cases, and I will mention that as something as a limitation in a moment. Immunization status, of note, 41% of our random sample cases did not have record of immunizations in their case investigation forms. Again, for those of you in the business, this is not surprising. In Texas, the registry is still undergoing some maturity, and it's not always completed as part of the case investigation to get full records of immunization status. And a pretty high prophylaxis administered percentage here that we in fact found in the random sample, 57% of our randomly sampled cases did have prophylaxis administered by us at the local health department. So looking at the covariates and what affected cost in terms of health department investigations, we saw that about half of the sample actually had full prophylaxis done, and the cost was heavily impacted as to when that occurred. And there, $321 versus $63, depending really on whether or not the prophylaxis was administered by the health department. This keep this in mind. This isn't just the per unit cost of the antimicrobial. This is also the time it takes to administer the antimicrobial as well. So a little bit more detail about antimicrobial administration for this. You can see that the mean number of persons given prophylaxis is 7.8 with a range of 1 to 29. Again, a wide range of numbers of potential case persons that you will have to give potentially prophylaxis to. At the time, this is 2004, we were using primarily erythromycin. Keep in mind azithromycin was not generic at the time, so we were not using Z-Pak from the health department. Thankfully, that has changed for the patients who just about anybody I know cannot tolerate erythromycin, so thankfully that has changed. In terms of covariates, language barriers did not affect the cost analysis, at least in our analysis. We did not see a difference in cost based on language spoken, and I will mention that as a limitation, the reason for that, I think, in the limitations. And when we did have immunization status available, there was not an inflection of cost differentials based on whether or not the case was in fact fully immunized or whether immunizations were up to date. So if we see here that a couple things I'd like to show, if we take the random sample and push it back into the 2004 data set, you can see that an estimated cost associated with the pertussis cases in 2004 for a local health department sits right at $90,000 with a range in the confidence intervals of $60,000 to $120,000, which is significant, of course. And the other thing I'd want to point out in this slide is the wide variation dependent heavily on the number of case reports you receive. And so really it's important to note that, you know, since we can't predict how many cases are going to occur next year, but yet we have to plan a budget in a local health department, this is a very challenging process because of the wide variation in case reports in cost dollars realized. So there are some limitations to this study. This was a retrospective review looking at estimations of time based on documentation in our case reports. We did not look at local travel costs, and Dallas County is a pretty big county. There was a lot of mileage that our nurse investigators were involved with. We did not capture that in this study. The translation costs, again, since the second language that was other than English spoken was Spanish, and we have bilingual persons in the health office, we didn't have additional translation costs, but certainly that should be a consideration for future cost analyses in terms of looking at those costs. And again, this was a random sample. We did not sample the entire data set in 2004. Keep in mind, the health department was the one conducting this study, and we were doing the stuff we normally do during the day, and so we weren't able to break away and do the complete analysis, but we did get a pretty good random sample. And we did not capture prophylaxis costs associated when the health department did not do the antimicrobial prophylaxis. So in conclusion, the average cost per case for an investigation by a local health department, I think we can say at $211, that's pretty conservative, I think, in the end, by the indicators that we've studied. The major determinant, of course, was whether or not prophylaxis was in fact given directly by the local health department or not. And language and immunization status, at least in our study, did not influence the cost as a variables. And again, I want to point out the variations in disease really can make budgetary planning very challenging for local health departments, particularly for disease investigations. Again, we can't predict how many pertussis cases we're going to have next year, so it's very hard to put a dollar amount into that upcoming budget. And this study really, I think, highlighted that. And finally, I think that this shows that the public health cost burden should be another consideration as part of the cost-benefits analyses that's done for pertussis immunizations or any other reportable vaccine-preventable disease in the future. And with that, I will thank you all for your attention today, and I'd like to also thank all the authors who participated. Many of them are in the room, so thank you all for contributing and participating. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for Q&A, some questions. And I have some questions if others don't stand up first. All right, my first question is for John. I'm curious, how broadly does the Dallas Health Department chemoprophylax? Do you focus on household contacts and high-risk contacts, or do you go after all close contacts?
Yeah, that's always a challenge, is who you decide to prophylax and who you don't. We typically use the standard definitions given to us from the Red Book and the communal disease manuals. I can tell you a lot of times that's not always easy to follow. We're pretty open with prophylaxis. Clearly, household contacts are given prophylaxis. Close contacts are recommended for prophylaxis. If there is somebody that wishes prophylaxis that is in fact not into those categories, we certainly say that you can receive such medications with in association with your private physician. But it is a challenge to make some of those determinations.
Right.
Hi, Ray Strickus, National Vaccine Program Office. Three very nice presentations. Question for Ms. Scoff. I just find it a little hard. I think you've raised most of the issues I would raise in thinking about why there's this fairly notable drop that you documented in pertussis cases in adolescents, but it's a fairly large drop and only 35% of these kids got Tdap. So I'm sitting here saying, well, are there any other possible explanations? Cyclical disease is certainly maybe high on my list, but I'm not terribly knowledgeable about pertussis epidemiology. The two things I wanted to ask you about is there any significant frequency of co-infection that leads to pertussis infection, such as we've been vaccinating kids against influenza increasingly over that same period of time, or which is one control measure that might be contributing. And I don't think it's any one thing, but that's one that crossed my mind. Another one is any change in antibiotic use, any new drugs out there, any changes in the way pediatricians use antibiotics that may have had a disproportionate effect on the incidence of pertussis. So I'm fishing for, are there additional explanations given the relatively modest increase in Tdap use, although gratifying over the last 3 years?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. As you saw, we tried to explore some other potential explanations for the declines. I mean, it's tricky when you have vaccine introduction at the height of the peak. You know, we're probably going to see disease rates coming back down, and how much of that can we attribute to a new vaccine? I think, you know, your question about prescribing trends, I think we don't know that at this point in time, and it's certainly something that we're interested in looking into. I think it's hard to say. I mean, there's the challenges with the diagnostics. You know, how much the disease are we actually detecting? Do we know the true burden of disease? Are these trends really reflective of what's really happening out there? So I think it's going to take more data and more time to really tease this apart and see what impact Tdap vaccination is having.
It's promising.
But it's, well, we're hopeful.
And Albert-Jan van Hoeken, HPA England. In line with this, do you know anything about the vaccine status of the pertussis case you saw in 2004? Because were it non-vaccinated people or were it vaccinated people?
I'm sorry, so you're asking about the vaccine status?
It's hard to hear up here.
Yeah,
it's hard
the vaccine status of the pertussis cases you saw in 2004.
The vaccine status. You know, this is national surveillance data, and there's a lot of limitations of our national surveillance data. I did not look at vaccine status for this analysis. You know, a lot of that data is incomplete at the national level, but that's certainly something we'll take a look at as well and correlate that. But we know overall coverage is still low, so with Tdap.
Yeah, but the pertussis vaccination in history, because that might be a group of susceptibles, what catched up. That might explain that it's going down in 2005, despite of vaccination.
Possible.
And I've got a question for Mr. Michael Jackson. Since it's only 2 years now that there is a low coverage of pertussis vaccination, you mentioned that only the first dose is given and not the boosting dose. What do you expect in, given that they had the first dose in the rise of disease, and what do you expect in the group till 2 years instead of under fives?
Sorry again, I had trouble hearing some of that. So what do we expect rates of disease to be doing?
Yeah, given that most kids had the first dose, if this is true, and if there's a problem with the first dose, shouldn't you look at the under twos instead of under fives?
Okay, so the HIV vaccines, there's the primary series, which is three doses now since we're all using the Sanofi product, and then the booster dose. So we're missing basically the booster dose for everyone except the small proportion that are high risk. And I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me a chance to talk as a total geek about some modeling that we're doing. So preliminarily, modeling suggests that if we just defer the booster dose over up to 2 years, there probably won't be too much of an effect of the shortage on HIV disease in the young kids. What we're also looking at is some data from Minnesota and some other vaccine registries suggest that there may be local supply issues so that not all kids are completing the primary series. and we're trying to get good numbers on how frequent that is, because that modeling suggests that that actually may have an important impact on rates of HIB in young kids. So the main lesson that we think we will take from these very preliminary data are that primary series coverage is really important when the booster dose is being deferred. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Garrett. Hi, Garrett Acey from CDC Immunization Services Division, and thank you very much for the presentations. And I have a question for John. First, I'm very happy that people are doing these types of studies. And I was just wondering, in your data, if school-based pertussis cases or school-based outbreaks, if you noticed more costs, because we've done some preliminary studies and we noticed that that's very expensive when you have a school-based outbreak.
Yep. Thanks. Yeah, it's a good question. For the data set that we looked at for this analysis, this was really just sporadic cases, so there really wasn't at the time, at least in the random series, any cases associated necessarily as being part of an outbreak. And I agree that there is additional costs associated when you're dealing with an outbreak setting for pertussis that really, so the goal for this study was to actually look at exactly the opposite and not have those effectors in this cost analysis.
Okay, thanks.
Trudy Murphy, CDC, and great talks, thank you. I have a question for Michael on the HIB talk. There are a number of countries that are using three-dose schedules, and I think in the U.S. we don't think that that's an ideal schedule for a lot of reasons. But I wonder if you could say something about the risk of disease and maybe the change in the disease pattern based on countries that use three doses, the three primary doses without a booster.
So, for example, the U.K., where for a long time they did a three-dose primary, no booster, is that what you're...
Right, in the Gambia and a number of South American countries. I think the UK may be a little bit different, but perhaps there's some things that could be learned too.
Right. So the UK experience is a little tricky because their program was they did a catch-up campaign and then started a three-dose primary series that knocked the rates of HIB down like we saw in the US very dramatically. And then 5-6 years out, they started seeing rates going up again. And one possible reason for that may have been that there was this lack of a booster dose, and that the booster dose seems to really impact the HIB colonization and maybe the big driver herd immunity. There were some other things that were going on at the same time in terms of the type of vaccine that was being used, so it's hard to be too causal in that. But from what we do know of the vaccines, it does appear that the booster dose really drives the herd protection. At this point, it looks like it's important for helping the keep disease down to the low levels. But again, just the primary series does knock disease down quite a bit. So in the U.S., but we'd expect that if you're just giving the primary series, you may not get down as far as you get when you've got a booster dose, but would still be a fairly dramatic reduction in the overall risk of disease.
Okay, well, I'm going to make a quick plug for a session tomorrow at 10:30. Our group, the Meningitis Vaccine and Preventable Diseases branch, is going to be hosting kind of an open dialogue with the audience to talk about our pertussis outbreak guidelines. And we're really hoping to get a good turnout from all the states because we want to hear what you have to say as we move forward with these revisions. So it's tomorrow at 10:30, and it's in this room. There's going to be an ad hoc meeting tonight at 5 o'clock about the draft national vaccine plan. It's going to be at 5 in the San Antonio B Ballroom. And also have some housekeeping announcements. The second immunization Q&A will take place in a Lone Star Ballroom, A1 and A2, during the lunch break, beginning in just a few minutes. Please feel free to bring your lunch with you. If you want more information, you can look on page 9 of your agenda book. The next session will begin at 2. Pages 27 and 28 of your agenda has information about those sessions. Please remember to take a few minutes during your lunch break to visit the exhibits and the posters. You can also maximize this time by visiting the Cyber Cafe and CE room located in the Lone Star Ballroom in A3. There's more. Please notice that a conference evaluation form is included in the back of your agenda. The conference planning team would appreciate knowing what you liked and what you disliked about this year's conference. Be sure to complete your evaluation form and deposit it in the boxes available in the back of the main ballroom, or drop it off at the information hospitality or registration desk. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your conference.